So today, this morning, we are beginning to look at what is the longest narrative in the book of Acts. The book of Acts is a lot of stories chronologically and not chronologically placed, but appropriately placed. And the story of Cornelius and Peter takes up 66 verses. From chapter 10, verse 1 to chapter 11, verse 18. A long and important passage, with lots of it being repeated. In fact, Peter and Cornelius. And Peter repeats this much later when the church in Jerusalem meets with him in chapter 15. It is a pivotal hinge in the account of the early church. It seems that right in the middle of all this activity, Luke decides, I am going to go into extremely great detail to make sure that everyone who comes after me and reads my words understands what takes place in this interaction. Peter was a Jewish follower of Christ, one who understood that Jesus was the promised Messiah. And Cornelius was a Roman citizen who was an adherent to the Jewish traditions. Two different men from two different heritages, and two different dynamics as relates to earthly power. And what we have in these verses before us today is how God works to reconcile those differences. It all comes through a world-changing vision. The vision that is recorded in verses 9 through 16. But before we get there and before we go into the aftermath of that, we need to understand the context for what happened. And so as we look at this passage, there are four major scenes, each one taking place one day after the next. And in the scriptures, you'll see this happens on the next day. On the next day, on the next day. And so let's begin by looking at verses 1 through 8. There is a context to a world-changing vision. And that context relates to a man called Cornelius. And we're given a lot of details about who Cornelius is. Cornelius lived in Caesarea, which is important. Caesarea was the Roman center of authority for Palestine. For all of the Jewish-occupied territory, the city of Caesarea was the source of that authority in Rome. The people of Israel were occupied by Rome at that time under the Caesars. And if you ever had any business with the government, you'd have to go to Caesarea. It was not the capital, but it was this place where governmental business took place. And this is where Cornelius lived. He was a centurion, literally the commander of 100 people. Or 100 soldiers. In order to be a centurion, he needed to be a Roman citizen. And so we understand that he is a Roman citizen. And we also understand that the regiment that he was in was the Italian regiment. He had come there from Rome. So, a Roman citizen, a citizen of the world, not a spiritually engrafted person in the faith of the Old Testament. yet what we read here in these verses is that he and his family were both devout and God-fearing. Now, what God-fearing and devout meant was that Cornelius had decided that the Jewish system was correct. And so, what he did was he understood the history of the Old Testament. He understood the laws of the Old Testament. And he committed to keeping the laws of the Old Testament. He would regularly attend, if he was devout, as it says, and a God-fearing man, he would regularly attend the synagogue in Caesarea. But one thing he didn't do, which distinguishes him from being Jewish in Luke's mind and being a God-fearing man in Luke's mind, is that he did not commit to the Jewish faith. In other words, he refused circumcision. He refused the sign of belonging. So he was there, but he wasn't them. And that's going to be important. He had not yet been incorporated, brought into the body. He was there, but not them. And Cornelius is given a vision by God. An angel, a messenger of God, appears to him in a vision and does two things. Cornelius is first commended. I have seen your righteous acts. Your righteous acts have risen up from earth, risen up to God as a memorial. Your gifts, your prayers, and your eleemosynary endeavors, your giving to the poor, your charitable gifts, all that you do to help those in need and to pray for those around you. I have heard, I have seen, God has heard, and he wants to bless you. The commend is your righteous acts have risen to God. And then he's commanded, send for Peter. Send for a man named Simon, who's also called Peter, who's at the house of Simon the Tanner, not to be confused with Simon, who is called Peter, who lives beside the sea in Caesarea. No doubt he must have understood that. So they are sent off. Three men are sent off. Two of his house servants and one of his soldiers. His second in command, likely, says the one that the soldier that was devoted to him. His chief of staff, as it were. These three men head off and go to visit with Peter. Now, they go to Joppa, sorry. The second thing we notice, verses 9 through 16, in this great vision that most of us have already heard of, there is a confrontation through a world-changing vision. Beginning with verse 9, the narrative switches to Peter's perspective as what's going on. About noon the following day, as they were on their journey to the city, Peter goes up to the roof to pray, which wouldn't have been uncommon. It was away from the hustle and bustle of the day. There were certain periods of time. 3 o'clock in the afternoon was one of them, as we found with Cornelius. 12 o'clock at noon was one of them, as we find with Peter. And he goes to the roof. It might have been cooler there, get a breeze, get away from everyone. But he is there, and he's praying, and it's lunchtime, and he's hungry. And he is put into a state of ecstasy. He's put into a trance, and what we can, in our common vernacular, an out-of-body experience. He's transported somewhere. Not physically, but mentally, spiritually. And what he sees is something. The Bible specifically says it is a vessel or a jar or a container that looks like a giant sheet. And it is immense. That its extremities go out to the end. This is a sheet that is covering the whole earth. And on the sheet are all the four-legged animals, and all the reptiles, and all the birds. Every kind of four-legged animal, rabbits, gophers, giraffes, every kind of reptile, Gila monsters, and I don't know, other reptiles, lizards, seems gross to me, but in birds, even worse. And he is commanded, get up, rise to your feet, Peter. Kill and eat. Literally, sacrifice and eat. Perform a spiritual ritual of offering these animals up to God and eat. And in this vision, it is not that he gets to choose and pick which animals he wants to sacrifice, which animals he wants to eat. The voice, a voice, says to him, sacrifice, in context, sacrifice them all. To which Peter gives a contradictory response that reveals his heart. He shares his inner core. He shares his heart in his contradictory response. Lord, voice that I hear that is in charge of my every action, I won't do that. I will not eat anything that is unclean or impure. Impure technically is the word koine, which is common, which is the culture of Greece, the Greek culture, the Gentile culture. I won't eat anything that is common, and by common, not of you, or unclean. I won't follow anything that is questionable. I won't follow anything that's against your law. I won't do it. This is not a new teaching. Jesus said, it doesn't go into their hearts, but into their stomachs and then out of their bodies. And in saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean in Mark 7:19. And this is repeated three times. This encounter is in a second time and a third time. It comes, and then once the voice says a third time, you are not to declare the things that I have made clean. You are not to declare them impure or common. And immediately the sheet is taken up. Now, while this is all going on, verses 17 to 23 and a half, we have the men return. The men come to the house. The three of them come to the house. And this is where we see that our third point, there is a conviction from a world-changing vision. As Peter is considering what has happened. Literally, this is the only time this word is used in the Bible, and it means to give serious thought. While he is working out, contemplating, reconciling, ruminating on what he has just heard and seen, the three men arrive at the gate. The voice says to Peter, go downstairs and go with them without delay, because I have sent them. He was expected to make an immediate course correction and go with them. But it is noontime, and he's hungry. And so instead of going without delay, without hesitation, Peter says, come into my house, you common men, you people from Roman Greek culture, you come into my house, even though it's not his house. Come in and I will treat you as a guest. I will have hospitality with you. I will have fellowship with you. I'm starving. Let's eat something. And as we think about this, this would not have been a great stretch for Peter. The Jewish people had sort of a system. You can invite unbelievers into your house, and that's okay. It's not the best, but it's okay. But you are not to go into an unbeliever's house. You can invite someone over for a meal who may or may not follow the Jewish dietary laws, because you're going to feed them what is appropriate. But you're not to go to someone else's house. So we can understand that there is starting to be a softening, but it isn't full yet. There is that conviction of saying, I'm going to do what God has told me to do, as opposed to saying, Lord, I will never do that, to a sudden, Lord, let me work on that. And then when we see in verses 23 and a half to 33, we see there is a confirmation that comes with a world-changing vision. Our fourth point, there's a confirmation. We've seen that there is a context to this vision, and there is a confrontation through this vision, and there's a conviction from this vision, and now there is a confirmation with this vision. Verse 23 and a half. The next day, Peter started out with them, and some of the brothers from Joppa went along. And then the following day, he arrived in Caesarea. Cornelius was expecting them and called together his relatives and his close friends. Peter and Cornelius finally meet. And Cornelius, upon seeing Peter, falls at his feet in worship. And you may think, wow, that's odd. And it would be odd for us to do that. But in first century Palestine, that was not uncommon. If you saw a hero, a war hero, a community leader, someone who was worthy of honor, you would fall at their feet and give them reverence. So it wouldn't have been inappropriate. It wouldn't have been a sign of a lack of faith. It's not idolatry. It's just a cultural norm. And what Peter says, which is pivotal in understanding the conviction that comes from God, is that his heart has changed. He was sharing his heart. He was sharing his core belief when he said, I will never eat anything that is impure or unclean. And now, after God has revealed God's heart, do not call anything impure that I have made clean. His heart changes. And he lifts up Cornelius and says, I'm no hero. I am a man myself. We are equals. You don't need to worship me because we are the same. He was reconciled through this vision. He recognizes that God had destroyed the power dynamic between Jew and Gentile. Different animals, but the same acceptance by God. Different peoples, but the same acceptance by God. Cornelius then reveals all that God had done in him, and in so doing reveals God's plan for the gospel. God told me to send for you. Peter goes in and says, what do you want from me? And Cornelius says, I have no idea. All I know is that an angel came to me and said, send for Peter. He lives with Simon the Tanner, who lives beside the sea. So, Peter, what have you got to tell us? Now, next week we will go into detail Peter's message to Cornelius and ultimately to the church as a whole. But ultimately, these four accounts set the stage, but also already we can see that Peter's heart has been changed. That he has gone from a worldview that says that there are distinctions among people, to a worldview that says, while there are differences, distinctives, there is no difference when it comes to God. I was mentioning this in Sunday school earlier today. That do you understand that the book of Revelation has John looking over the massive crowd of people in the throne room of God, and he sees and hears people from every tribe, nation, tongue, and people. And sometimes we think that heaven is going to be this homogenous group, that there is, you know, I don't see color, I don't see culture, I just accept everyone as they are. God doesn't see it that way. God delights in culture. God delights in different languages. God delights in creativity. And so there are, as John looks out into heaven, he sees different cultures and different peoples and hears different languages. But he sees also that they are all together in Christ. All these scenes are intended to reinforce in our minds what God shares as he shares his heart with Peter. The voice spoke to him a second time. Do not call anything impure. Do not call anything common or cultural that God has made clean. That goes for animals and actions, and it goes for people too. Our sermon in a sentence is this. The first thing. Are we stuck? Yeah, there we go. The first thing believers do to change the world is change their heart. We need to appreciate culture and class and ethnicity. Without classification, without hierarchy, without saying, I'm better, we're better, this is better. While the world may say that, our culture is better than the rest. Our people are better than the rest. We ought to be saying what God says. Here there is no Gentile or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and Christ is in all. God's not calling us to be colorblind, but to be inclusive of all colors and tribes and tongues and nations and peoples. That's what changed the world 2,000 years ago, and that is what continues to change the world today. But it requires us to go through what Peter went through and recognize that who God calls, God calls. And there is no distinction. There is no levels of God's acceptance. It requires us to change our hearts. The first thing believers do to change the world is change their heart. Shall we pray?